Blog Talk Radio. Greetings, this is Abayomi Azikiwe, and welcome back to another edition of the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine. It's brought to you here on a weekly basis. I am your host, Abayomi Azikiwe. Today is Saturday, April the 6th, 2024. We're broadcasting from our studios in downtown Detroit. We would like to thank all of our listeners for tuning in once again to yet another edition of the Pan-African Journal. Later on in our program, we'll be coming up with our regular Pan-African Newswire report. We'll have dispatches on the speech by Lebanese Hezbollah Secretary General Saeed Hassan Nasrallah, who spoke yesterday on the attacks by the IDF on the Iranian embassy in Syria. Protests took place internationally in commemoration of Al-Quds Day. The West African state of Togo has arrested leading opposition figures, and the South African state of Zimbabwe is introducing a new currency. In the second and third hours, we listened to a panel discussion from Electronic Intifada, one of the primary sources on the situation in Palestine and West Asia, discussing the current situation in Palestine. These and other features will be brought to you during the course of our program. Stay tuned. We'll take our musical interlude with the Mkhal's Tomb Orchestra. This is from a concert in 1961. Let's listen in.
سلطت الأضواء الآن على الستار القرمزي وتطلعت الأنظار إلى اختلاجة خفيفة تبدو على الستار الذي استمعنا منذ لحظات إلى دقة ودقة ثم دقة أخيرة لعله أن يتبعها أن ينفرج هذا الستار عن كوكب الشرق السيدة أم كلثوم. واستقبل الحاضرون السيدة أم كلثوم بهذه العاصفة من التصفيق تحية لها وسنستمع إلى أغنية لسه فاكر قلبي لديلك أمان.
I'm feeling. I'm not. Thank you. ما عرفنا النهاية
وسادتي، لا أحسب بعد أن غنت أم كلثوم أنكم في حاجة إلى مزيد. استقبلت أم كلثوم بهذا التصفيق الصادق الذي يعبر عن مشاعر الحاضرين هنا حبا وإعجابا وتقديرا، وفتحت الستار عدة مرات وخرجت من ورائها أم كلثوم ترد تحية الحاضرين هنا في مسرح حديقة الأزبكية. وكنتم في حاجة إلى تعليق، لو لم تكن هي كما كانت دائما فوق القمة دائما، بل هي في ذاتها قمة في روعتها وفي سحر غنائها وفي شدوها الجميل. سيداتي وسادتي، لنا لقاء آخر مع كوكب الشرق السيدة أم كلثوم من هذا المكان مسرح حديقة الأزبكية بالقاهرة. والآن يعود بكم الميكروفون إلى دار الإذاعة بالقاهرة.
The music of the North African state of Egypt, that was Umm Kalsum and her orchestra from a concert in 1961 in the North African state of Egypt. And Umm Kalsum was known as the Star of the East. This is the Pan-African Journal, worldwide radio broadcast for Saturday, April 6, 2024. We're broadcasting from our studios in downtown Detroit. Right now, we'd like to move into our Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal. And we're going to go through some of the headlines in today's Pan-African Journal. And the Pan-African Journal is available 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, over our website, and we'll give that out just at the conclusion of this report. Our lead story deals with the situation in West Asia. In the state of Lebanon, Hezbollah Secretary General Saeed Hassan Nasrallah spoke on the occasion of Al-Quds Day, discussing multiple topics such as the ongoing war on Gaza and the recent Israeli attack on Iran's consulate. Al-Quds Day, the day dedicated to expressing solidarity with Palestine, occupied Palestine, and commemorating on the last day of the holy month of Ramadan, quote, represents our commitment, our position, our resistance, and our high hopes, unquote, for liberation. Hezbollah Secretary General Saeed Hassan Nasrallah said yesterday. Saeed Nasrallah addressed the Israeli aggression on the Iranian consulate in Syria, stressing that, quote, the martyrs of the recent Israeli aggression on Damascus are of historical value for us, unquote. He goes on to say that, quote, the martyrdom of these dear ones is a great matter for us, especially Brigadier General Zaidi, for his great offering in the resistance in Lebanon over many years, unquote, adding that, quote, this incident is a turning point. The Iranian president, Imam Khomeini, decisive, Iran's leader, the supreme leader, Imam Khomeini, decisive declaration of standing by the Palestinian cause was one of the main reasons for the wars that Iran has been subjected to, Saeed Nasrallah said, linking the attack on Iran's consulate to the latter support for the Palestinian cause. He pointed out that, quote, the Americans strongly desired direct negotiations with the Iranians, but Iran has so far refused direct negotiations, adding Iran does not negotiate on regional issues with the Americans. He added, we hear about the nonsense that everything's happening in the region is an American-Iran charade, explaining there were many parties who are unable to accept that Israel is defeated in the region, and they are unable to understand that. Iran is offering its high-ranking leaders as martyrs, and Tehran's position is decisive and is being cemented with the blood of its martyrs, said Saeed Nasrallah. Iran has been a supporter of everyone who resists this entity since 1979, and its support has changed many equations. If Iran wanted to change its position, would have done so decades ago, he added. All the resistance fighters who rely on Iran should be confident that Iran will not abandon the oppressed, nor will it abandon its allies. And in other news, as we mentioned in the previous report, yesterday was Al-Quds Day. Yemenis on Al-Quds Day underlined that they were committed to see the Palestinian cause despite all the hardship and in light of the injustices they face. We renew our pledge of allegiance to God, his messenger, and our blessed leadership in our commitment to the support of the Palestinian people, a statement issued by the organizers of the Million Man demonstrations taking place in Yemen to commemorate Al-Quds Day. The Yemeni people stress that they were prepared to implement the directions of the wise leadership when it comes to any action they take to stand in the face of the enemies of humanity. We stress that the Palestinian cause is ours and the Ummah principle cause. Ummah must protect sanctities and take action to liberate them, it said. No regime in any Islamic country can explain their inaction or failure to play their respective role in the liberation of Palestine and in supporting the Palestinian people. The battle for the liberation of Al-Quds is not solely the obligation of the Palestinian people. It is the responsibility of the Ummah as a whole, the statement read. And you can read these articles in their entirety over the Pan-African Newswire, and you're listening to the Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal. In the West African state of Togo, nine politicians who were running a campaign against a new constitution that would allow President Faure Gnassingbé to extend his 19-year rule have been arrested, a spokesperson for the opposition coalition said on Thursday. Opposition voices are growing in a tiny phosphate-producing country over constitutional reform that could change the way the president is elected. Some members of the opposition coalition were detained the day before on Wednesday in the afternoon while they were campaigning against the constitution at a market in the suburbs of the Togolese capital of Lomé, spokesperson Thomas Nsupwa said. Others were detained at night during a meeting at the house of a coalition member. Togo's opposition party started their campaign after the National Assembly adopted the new constitution that lengthens presidential terms by 1 year to 6 from 5 while limiting the number of terms to 1. Under the new constitution, which introduces a parliamentary system of government, the president will no longer be elected by universal suffrage, but by members of parliament. The constitution does not take into account the time already spent in office, which could enable Faure Gnassingbé to stay in power until 2031 if he is elected in 2025. In reaction to opposition forced voices, the president's office on Wednesday announced nationwide consultations on the revision of the Constitution and delayed parliamentary and regional elections initially scheduled for April the 20th. Several parties condemned this decision and called for demonstrations on April 11th, 12th, and the 13th. Finally, in the southern African state of Zimbabwe, the country will introduce new structured currency linked to foreign currencies and gold that it expects to provide more stability than its weakening dollar and help rein in inflation, its central bank governor, John Mushabanhu, said yesterday. As the Zimbabwe dollar tumbled this year from under 6,000 to 29,000 to the U.S. dollar, annual inflation soared beyond 55% in March, evoking bitter memories of hyperinflation under the former leadership of President Robert Mugabe. The new currency, called the Zimgo, will be backed by foreign currencies, gold, and precious metals, Mushayavanu told a press conference in the capital of Harare, adding that it would circulate alongside a basket of other currencies. He said the central bank would also introduce a market-determined exchange rate. If we implement these measures, we expect them to have an impact on inflation, Mushayavanhu said. The central bank also set its main interest rate at 20%, which it said was a recalibrated rate, a drastic cut from the previous rate of 130%. Finance Minister Mthuli Ncube said in February that authorities were considering linking the exchange rate the hard assets such as gold and creating a currency board. The announcement is the culmination of months of deliberations between the central bank and the finance ministry about how to arrest inflation and stabilize the Zimbabwean dollar. With that, we're going to conclude the Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal. And in concluding this segment of our program, we'd like to remind our listeners that the Pan-African Newswire is an international electronic press service. It is designed to foster intelligent discussions on the affairs of African people throughout the continent and the world. The press agency was founded in January of 1998. Since then, it has published tens of thousands of articles and dispatches in hundreds of newspapers, magazines, journals, research reports, and on blogs and websites throughout the world. The Pan-African Newswire represents the only daily international news source on Pan-African and global affairs. If you'd like to log on to the Pan-African Journal and the Pan-African Newswire, to go to the Pan-African Newswire, just log on to panafricannews.blogspot.com. That's panafricannews.blogspot.com. If you'd like to have access to today's Pan-African Journal worldwide radio broadcasts, just go to the Pan-African Radio Network. That's at blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. That's blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. And we'll take a break, and we'll be back with more of the Pan-African Journal for this week. And, of course, I am your host, Abayomi Azikiwe. Sound of Rotary Connection, the lead vocals of Shirley Walls and the others on that classic album, the last album for Rotary Connection, known then as the new Rotary Connection from 1971. And you're listening to the Pan-African Journal special worldwide radio broadcast, and of course, we have been following the situation in Gaza, in the occupied Palestinian territories, along with the entire West Asia and North Africa region. And we're going to listen to an update from Electronic Intifada from 3 days ago on the 180th day of the genocide in Gaza. Electronic Intifada is one of the primary sources on the situation in Gaza. Their website provides primary sources, people writing from Gaza who have been there, who are still there. Let's listen to Electronic Intifada.
Hello and welcome back to the Electronic Intifada's live stream for Wednesday, April 3rd. Thank you so much for tuning in. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman with my colleagues Ali Abunima, Asa Wynn-Stanley, John Elmer, and Tamara Nassar. It's day 180 of Israel's genocide in Gaza. We have another packed show for you today, including a discussion with our contributor Abu Bakr Abed in Gaza. We'll also be joined by Canada-based Dr. Yipeng Gui to talk about his recent medical delegation to Gaza. Our colleague David Cronin will join us to talk about why he was censored by a Dutch university. And later on in the program, of course, a full roundup of videos from the Palestinian armed resistance with John Elmer. But first, some of the news that we've been covering at the Electronic Intifada. On Monday morning, the Israeli army withdrew after two continuous weeks of attacking, besieging, and destroying the entire Al-Shifa medical complex in Gaza City. During its siege on Al-Shifa Hospital, the largest medical facility in the Gaza Strip, Israel destroyed, quote, all buildings and departments without exception in a clear crime that shames humanity, according to the Gaza Government Media Office. The army faced fierce battles from Palestinian resistance factions, some of which we'll get into with John later on in the program. When the families of patients, medical staff, and displaced persons who were trapped inside the hospital and its grounds during Israel's raid and massacres returned to retrieve their loved ones, many found bodies in fragments, flattened under bulldozer treads. Children's corpses were discovered burned beyond recognition. The Gaza government media office added that, quote, inside the complex and its surroundings, the occupation army killed more than 400 martyrs and attempted to hide its abominable crime by executing hundreds of civilians, the wounded and the sick within the walls of the Al-Shifa medical complex. They covered the bodies with piles of sand, bulldozed them, buried them, and mixed them with the ground of the complex. Moreover, more than 300 prisoners were arrested, while over 100 Palestinian civilians are still missing as a result of the occupation's shocking crime. Hundreds of bodies inside Al-Shifa complex and in the surrounding area were found burned and mutilated, including corpses, quote, with their heads and limbs severed, stated the Geneva-based Euro-Mediterranean Human Rights Monitor. The group called Israel's destruction and slaughter at Al-Shifa one of the largest massacres in Palestinian history. Physicians were executed, and more than 20 patients were found dead in their hospital beds, quote, as a result of the Israeli siege of the complex and the deliberate deprivation by Israeli soldiers of medical care, food, and water, Euromed stated on Monday. Israeli lawmakers and political figures have repeated claims that the hospital complex was used as a Hamas and Islamic Jihad command center. Naftali Bennett, Israel's former prime minister, called the destruction of Al-Shifa a quote, amazing battlefield achievement. Hamas used staff and patients as human shields in order to cause maximum civilian casualties as to create more criticism and pressure on Israel, Bennett claimed, adding that, quote, not one civilian was killed, not one. Israel's military chief of staff, Herzl Halevi, boasted on Saturday that the army's siege of Al-Shifa sends, quote, a very, very important message here. A hospital is not a safe place. Physicians from Al-Shifa held a press conference on Monday on the ruins of the hospital grounds. Here's the head of the nursing department, Dr. Jadala Sahafi, speaking to Al Jazeera.
With deep regret, we have come to see this shocking scene at Al-Shifa Medical Complex. The scale of deliberate destruction and willful annihilation of the facilities and the infrastructure by the Israelis are beyond description. What we have witnessed is nothing compared to what we have seen. It is a deliberate act against Gaza's symbol, Al-Shifa Medical Complex, the largest in the Gaza Strip, catering to more than 2,000 patients and performing more than 100 surgical operations in a single day. It is now a total wreck. The Israelis are purposefully ruining Gaza's entire health sector. Patients and medical staff were besieged for more than 15 days without the basic necessities for life, let alone medical supplies. Dead bodies decomposed, reeking and bloated. There were worms crawling out of them. In addition to the forcible expulsion of patients and displaced civilians sheltering within the compound, it is a full-fledged war crime by the Israelis. About 30 medical staff are not accounted for, and we do not know what has become of them. Were they executed or detained? We call on the International Red Cross and all international organizations to help us locate their whereabouts.
That was Dr. Jadala Sahafi, the head of Al-Shifa Hospital's nursing department, speaking to Al Jazeera on Monday. Doa Shaheen, writing in the Electronic Intifada, reported that a man named Salim Baraka saw, quote, the kind of horror no parent should ever have to endure. The Israeli military killed his son Karim right in front of him. Shaheen writes, quote, like so many others, Salim and Karim fled from their home in Jabalia refugee camp, northern Gaza, during the current genocidal war. They took shelter at Al-Shifa, Gaza's largest hospital. They were inside the hospital when it was stormed by Israeli forces on March 18th. Salim recalled how he spent the following week, quote, waiting to die. Quote, quadcopter drones were firing wildly, striking anything that moved, he said. The Israelis smashed the glass in the windows and destroyed the walls in the department where we were hiding. A shell fell on us and killed my son in front of my eyes, he added. I could not save him. He bled to death. The situation, in Salim's words, was, quote, worse than hell. For much more, read Doa Shaheen's feature, Siege of Gaza's Largest Hospital, Worse Than Hell, and my post, Al-Shifa Hospital in Ruins, on electronicintifada.net. The day before it withdrew from Al-Shifa, the Israeli army bombed tents housing displaced persons and journalists in the courtyard of the Al-Aqsa Hospital in Deir al-Balah in central Gaza. At least 4 people were killed and 17 others were wounded in the Israeli airstrike. Hind Hodari, who has contributed to the Electronic Intifada and works as a reporter for Al Jazeera, was inside one of the tents for working journalists. She told the network that, quote, everyone is terrified here. They have been seeking refuge inside this hospital for more than 6 months now, she said. Last week, the Switzerland-based Insecurity Insight Research Institution reported that there have now been more than 1,000 recorded attacks on healthcare in the occupied West Bank and Gaza Strip since October 7th. 785 attacks on healthcare facilities were reported over the last 6 months of Israel's genocide in Gaza, the group stated, while 175 attacks were on facilities in the West Bank. Most of these attacks involved airstrikes damaging or destroying hospitals and clinics and killing health workers. Insecurity Insight stated that the Israeli army's, quote, unrelenting aerial attack on the Strip has had a catastrophic and far-reaching impact on the population and the healthcare system. Over the weekend, the International Court of Justice issued new provisional measures stating that Israel must take all necessary and effective measures to ensure, without delay and in full cooperation with the United Nations, the unhindered provision at scale by all concerned of urgently needed basic services and humanitarian assistance to Palestinians throughout the Gaza Strip. Euromed Human Rights Monitor stated that, quote, the fresh ICJ order observes that Palestinians in Gaza are no longer facing only the risk of famine, but that famine is setting in and that the pre-January catastrophic humanitarian situation in the Strip has further deteriorated. The court says that its earlier orders, which it issued on January 26th, did not fully address the consequences arising from the changes in the situation in Gaza. According to the ICJ's new order, Israel must ensure the unhindered provision at scale of basic services and humanitarian assistance, including food, water, fuel, shelter, clothing, hygiene, and sanitation requirements, and medical supplies, plus increase the capacity and number of land crossing points and keep them open for as long as necessary, Euromed Human Rights Monitor said. However, Israel's engineered starvation of Palestinians in Gaza remains in full swing, and the army has not stopped targeting people awaiting aid, it has not stopped blocking the aid, and it has not stopped targeting aid workers. Overnight on Tuesday, as Tamara Nassar reported, the Israeli Air Force struck a convoy of aid workers in Deir al-Balah, central Gaza, killing 7 members of the U.S.-based World Central Kitchen charity. An Israeli Elbit Hermes 450 drone, quote, fired 3 missiles one after the other, according to the Tel Aviv newspaper Haaretz, from unnamed defense sources privy to the details of the attack. The aid team, quote, was traveling in a deconflicted zone in 2 armored cars branded with the World Central Kitchen logo and a softskin vehicle, World Central Kitchen said. Graphic images depicting the corpses of aid workers clad in bulletproof vests bearing the logo of World Central Kitchen circulated on social media, Tamara writes. She adds that the World Central Kitchen announced the immediate suspension of all of its operations in the region. Ships that had already set sail from Cyprus as part of the charity's operations were reportedly turning back. ANERA, a U.S. charity providing humanitarian aid to Palestinians, also announced a pause in its operations in Gaza. It was the second largest humanitarian aid group in the Gaza Strip after the UN Agency for Palestine Refugees, or UNRWA. ANERA said that, quote, the unprecedented scale of the current conflict and the disregard for international law necessitate this historic pause in our operations. The Gaza Logistics and Support Coordinator for the group, Musa Shawa, was also killed in an Israeli strike on Deir al-Balah last month. Israel's military chief of staff, Herzl Halevi, said that, quote, the strike on World Central Kitchen was not carried out with the intention of harming aid workers. He added, it was a mistake that followed a misidentification at night during a war in very complex conditions. It shouldn't have happened. John Kirby, the U.S. State Department spokesperson, said, quote, there's no evidence that the Israeli army killing of World Central Kitchen staff was deliberate.
Presumes at this very early hour that it was a deliberate strike, that they knew exactly what they were hitting, that they were hitting aid workers and did it on purpose, and there's no evidence of that. I would also remind you, sir, that we continue to look at incidents as they occur. The State Department has a process in place. And to date, as you and I are speaking, they have not found any incidents where the Israelis have violated international humanitarian law. And lest you think we don't take it seriously, I can assure you that we do. We look at this in real time.
They have never violated international humanitarian law ever in the past 5 to 6 months.
I'm telling you, the State Department has looked at incidents in the past and has yet to determine that any of those incidents violate international humanitarian law.
That was John Kirby of the U.S. State Department. In her report, Tamara Nassar explains that, quote, Israel's genocide in the Gaza Strip over the last 6 months has been marred by attempts to whitewash the man-made catastrophe with humanitarian gestures. The latest face of this effort has been the World Central Kitchen, which describes itself as, quote, first to the front lines, providing meals in response to humanitarian, climate, and community crises. The only reason the World Central Kitchen has been able to deliver aid into Gaza by boat is because the genocidaires of Gaza have given them the green light and safe passage to do so, Tamara notes. The New York Times reported that, quote, every step was carried out with permission from the Israeli military when it spoke to the charity's director of emergency response. Tamara writes that, quote, there remains no technical reason why aid trucks should not be able to enter Gaza by land. It is the most efficient, cost-effective, and safe method of delivering aid to Gaza, and aid trucks remain stuck at the Rafah crossing with Egypt unable to enter Gaza because Israel won't let them in. Washington refuses to use any of its enormous leverage to compel Tel Aviv to do so or to end the siege on Gaza altogether. The construction of a temporary pier and the dropping of aid packages from the sky are political gestures aimed at maneuvering and establishing political realities on the ground. For much more on this story, read my colleague Tamara Nassar's latest report, Aid to Gaza, Suspended After Israel Murders World Central Kitchen Workers, on electronicintifada.net. And we'll also be discussing the World Central Kitchen story later on in this program. And finally, the Biden administration is urging members of Congress to approve the sale of up to 50 F-15 fighter jets to the Israeli military in a deal worth more than $18 billion. CNN reported that the arms deal, quote, which would amount to the largest U.S. foreign military sale to Israel since October 7th, comes as the administration is also expected to notify Congress soon of a large new sale of precision-guided munition kits to Israel, according to CNN's sources. And that's just some of the news from on the ground in Palestine over the last few days. Please go to electronicintifada.net to read some of our crucial new features by writers in Gaza, now up on our homepage. And you're watching and listening to the Electronic Intifada live stream. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. Coming up, we'll have Dr. Yipeng Gui on to talk about the health catastrophe in Gaza. Our colleague David Cronin will talk about why he was censored by a Dutch university, and we'll get a full update from John Elmer on the latest military developments in Gaza. But first, Ali Abu Nima and I are delighted to be joined once again by our contributor, Abu Bakr Abed, live and direct from Gaza. Is Abu Bakr here? Oh, you're muted, Ali.
We're still trying to connect with him. I think it's okay. Going to be a couple of minutes. We're hopeful that we're going to get Abu Bakr. But Nora, that was a very tough news roundup as usual.
Yeah.
And it just feels like the past few days, things are just escalating worse and worse. It's difficult to keep track of. I mean, it already seems like a year since we were talking about the horrors at El Shifa, and it's just a couple of days ago.
Yeah.
And now you have the murder of the World Central Kitchen staff. I think we're going to come back to that later in the show because there's a lot of questions about it, but there's no question whatsoever that Israel murdered these people. And, you know, even if we have, I think, legitimate questions about the role of World Central Kitchen in Gaza, certainly there's no justification for the murder of individuals who, by all accounts, you know, some of them, of the people who were killed, have longstanding records as humanitarian workers. And of course, one of the staff killed, one of the seven people killed, is a Palestinian. So it's just horror after horror.
Yeah, I think, I mean, it was quite a day, Monday, and then overnight on Tuesday, the withdrawal of the Israeli army from Shifa after a two-week siege, seeing the carnage that Israel had left behind, seeing these photographs, you know, that I didn't want to put in the news report because they're too gruesome, but just the aftermath of Israel's slaughter. I mean, they turned Shifa into a slaughterhouse and the ground around it. Yeah.
It barely makes an impact anymore. I mean, this is...
Yeah, I don't know if it was even, you know, properly covered.
Yeah, if you remember back in October, the massacre at the Al Ahli Hospital.
Right.
You know, and that was a big international story. And they raised questions about, oh, was it really Israel who did this? There was the, you know, completely implausible theory that a rocket from a resistance group had killed dozens or hundreds of people. And, you know, that was a big story then. Now literally every hospital has been taken out of service. And we're going to hear from Dr. Yipeng Gi, who was in Gaza. One thing I should say, actually, speaking of the work of doctors going to Gaza, is yesterday, so that was Tuesday evening, the White House attempted to hold an iftar meal with Muslims. And, you know, there's been, by the way, I checked this. Little quiz here, Nora. Who hosted more White House iftars as president, Joe Biden or Donald Trump?
I'm going to say Trump.
Yeah, it was Donald Trump. In fact, Joe Biden has never held a White House iftar. He has had, and partly that, you know, you could say that was due to the pandemic. But the past 2 years, he's held like an Eid al-Fitr reception. So a reception for the Eid at the end of Ramadan, but not a White House iftar. And they attempted to hold one yesterday, and it was apparently a disaster. It was going, according to the press reporting, there was only supposed to be about a dozen people there anyway, because, and probably some of them are White House staff. Yeah. And because apparently most people who are invited refused to show up. Some people did agree to go and apparently left in protest. One of them, according to Al Jazeera, was Dr. Thaer Ahmed, who we had on the live stream a couple of weeks ago, who had spent a few weeks in Gaza. And I've seen people saying, you know, no one should have gone at all. But what is reported is that Dr. Thaer Ahmed handed over a letter from a child in Gaza to Biden. I mean, you could say that's a powerful gesture in some ways, but it's not as if Biden and his henchmen don't know what's happening and are going to be moved by things like that. I don't know what you think.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, Biden and his henchmen know exactly what they're doing in Gaza. They know, they see the same photographs and videos that we see. They're 100% committed to keeping Israel armed and keeping Israel covered for this genocide. I think it was a powerful protest that Dr. Ahmed engaged in during this like deranged iftar.
But they're still trying. I mean, the really, I mean, I'm trying to watch my language because this is a family show, but you know, they're still trying to present this administration as if it is, you know, on the side of Palestinians and Arabs and Muslims.
Right.
And, you know, this month, April, is Arab American Heritage Month. And I don't know if you saw the unhinged proclamation that Joe Biden issued to celebrate Arab American Heritage Month. And I mean, it just makes them look so much more out of touch, so much more insulting, so much more contemptuous of people. It's beyond it.
Right.
It's
beyond
imagination.
And the closer that we get to this like dreadful election, they're going to be pandering in the most depraved way to Muslims and Arab Americans and people in, you know, swing states like Wisconsin and Michigan.
Except in the one way that Arabs, Muslims and Americans of every background are demanding, which is that Joe Biden force Israel, because he can, to comply with the ceasefire demanded by the UN Security Council a week ago.
Right. I mean, that's the bar is on the floor.
Yeah.
That's how low it is. Just to do that, he is refusing. He's refusing. Yeah. He's refusing to comply with international law. He's, you know, people like John Kirby are out there saying, that Israel has not violated one international humanitarian legal precedent in the last 6 months. I mean, they really...
And there's a reason for that. I'm just seeing a message from Tamara. We're still working to connect with Abu Bakr, and I hope we will. I think we'll be able to. But, you know, about that clip in the news brief of Kirby saying that, oh, we haven't, you know, and that journalist saying in 5 months you haven't seen a single incident where Israel has violated international humanitarian law. And there's a reason. I mean, Kirby knows he's lying. You can even see the smirk on his face as he tells those lies. And same thing with Matthew Miller and Vedant Patel and the other people at the State Department. They have to tell that lie, because if they say that, yes, we found even a single incident where Israel is violating international humanitarian law, then they have to acknowledge that it is illegal for the United States under U.S. law to be transferring weapons to Israel.
Yeah.
Because the U.S. law, there's the Leahy law and other provisions that make it illegal to transfer weapons to a country that is using them to commit such atrocities, or that is blocking humanitarian aid, as Israel is openly doing. And instead, what the Biden administration is doing, and in the, you know, this happens every week, there's an announcement of new arms shipments, but they just announced over the last couple of days, as the reports from Al-Shifa were coming out, of the just house of horrors, endless horror upon horror, that the Biden administration is approving more shipments of 2,000-pound bombs to Israel. And so it's just so utterly depraved.
Completely. Completely. I mean, you know, we watch the worst thing that's ever happened day after day after day after day. And this week is going to mark 6 months, although time seems meaningless right now. A lot of things seem meaningless. I cannot comprehend the scale of this genocide and how it's just continuing to unfold minute by minute.
And you remember back at the beginning when we would be on and talking about this, when there would be reports that, oh, the administration's giving them till the end of December. Oh,
right.
Then it became the middle of January. Then it became the end of January. And now it's just, they don't even talk about ending it, because they were trying to give Israel enough time to, quote unquote, finish the job, to destroy Hamas. And, you know, 6 months in, Israel has only achieved mass murder, not a single, you know, military achievement. No. Oh, it looks like Abu Bakr is able to join
us.
Oh,
fantastic. Okay, let's bring him on. Abu Bakr.
Hi.
Hi. It's so good to see you.
Hi, Abu Bakr. How are you?
Oh, it looks like...
It looks like he is... he's muted. I hope we're able to connect. People know how difficult it is to connect with anyone in Gaza, but Abu Bakr was very keen to join us, and we were very keen to have him. And it's so important to continue to hear from people in Gaza, to hear their voices, to hear their experiences. And what I'm hearing...
Here he is.
Hello, Abu Bakr.
Hi.
Hi.
Tell us how you're doing. We know that just before you joined us, there was a bombing close by. Are you okay? Is everything all right? Give us a sense of what's happening there.
It's all okay. It's all right, by the way, because I think there was an explosive bombing close from Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital in Al Zawaida area. And it was very, very, it was massive, and we don't know whether there are casualties, but for sure, yes, there are casualties. But at the same time, yes, bombings haven't stopped since the early morning. And even now, if you can hear in the background, there are still continuous bombings happening right now. So the situation overall is good. We say it's good, but it's in fact very risky and unsafe.
Alhamdulillah ala salamitkum. And I don't know if you can see all of the messages in the chat from the many, many people, more than 2,000 people watching us live, who are saying that they're praying for your safety and the safety of your family, Abu Bakr. There's a lot of people sending you love.
I really thank every one of them, and I really appreciate that. You know, as you said, It's been an absolute difficulty to join you today, but as I've told you, I was keen, I was insistent, and yes, I'm here with you today.
Abu Bakr, maybe we can bring up the piece that you wrote for us a few days ago, and have you talk a little bit about it. Let's see if we can find it. Yeah. So tell us about your latest feature that you wrote for the Electronic Intifada. And how you're able to work, to report, to write, to interview people in under these conditions.
Well, look, this piece particularly is the hardest ever, because it conveys the reality behind our life, my life particularly, and my family's, right now under these circumstances. If you think about it, I really don't want to comment further, but look, since you have asked, I don't know why you wrote this one and how I wrote this one, because literally, if I write more about the heartbreaks, about the atrocities my family and I are going through alongside people here around us, it's going to take millions of words. When you look at it and you read every single letter conveys a message, because it's gone beyond the literal and the connotation of what a tragedy means. During this Ramadan, now we are in the 23rd day of Ramadan. Ramadan should have been a month of contemplation, a month of relief, a month of closeness from God, a month of happiness and celebrations. But I really don't know what the word celebration means anymore.
Abu Bakr, I want to just share a few lines from your piece. And you're right, every line, every word of it is very deeply moving and conveys so much. But you say, the background image on my mobile phone shows French fries and ketchup. Whenever my two-year-old niece sees the phone, she licks its screen. Her own mother cannot give her enough food. My other nephews and nieces play a frightening war game. They imagine that a missile has hit and killed them. One of my sisters is pregnant. She is filled with dread. Just those three sentences capture so much. But I just want to ask you now, regarding, you just now passed iftar time in Gaza, where people are breaking their fast. How are people breaking their fast? What is the situation in terms of just the most basic needs now, food, water, medicine, and so on? And we know that that's leaving aside the constant risk of bombing and deaths from the air.
Yes, it's if you look at what people are breaking the fast on, it's absolutely heartbreaking, because initially, look, this is what we eat, because what we eat, as I've told you, the worst quality ever you can have in terms of food. And now, because this is something to bring you, by the way, and to bring the audience, I'm probably not the same as I talked to you earlier last month, because it's in fact that I'm ill. I'm very sick at the moment. I'm having a gastritis, and at the same time, I'm having a battle of tendonitis. I'm sick. Tamara has known that, by the way, but I was insistent and keen to speak to you with you today. Look, why have I contracted this? It's because of the quality of food we have and the malnutrition. How can people are now just breaking their fast on the little things they have, which is like lentil soup, some dates, and some dates that are not even, you know, they are rotten, in fact, you know, they're not even good to eat or to taste. It's at the same time that we don't eat. Look, eating sometimes gives you a sense of, you know, enjoyment, of joy, and at the same time, eating is relief. It's probably a therapy for most people. But how can this be if you really don't have anything to do for iftar or at the same time support? I swear I'm taking more than 4 medications at the moment so that I make sure that my stomach ache is not going back anymore. It's not going to be back anymore. It is the same thing for the whole people here in the Gaza Strip. What we are receiving from food and water, the contaminated parts of all of this are absolutely lethal. That's why when you are going out in the streets and see people inside the hospitals, they are, hospitals are filled with hepatitis A, with jaundice, and with infections at the same time. That's a symptom of the Israelis warring on Gaza. So that's why one is just a heartbreak.
And Abu Bakr, when you do go out into the streets, are there any agencies operating in Gaza? Is UNRWA operating in your area? Are there other international humanitarian agencies or charities operating in your area? Are they able to get food, medicine to people around you and your community?
This is, look, in my area, UNRWA is only operating in schools. That means only few people receive aid from medications, food, and other stuff. It's the same thing for most people. If UNRWA works only in schools, what about the thousands outside in tents and in the streets? What about the thousands in houses who have stayed in their houses under destroyed roofs? What about the others outside in the streets who are suffering and war injured at the same time? For the World Central Kitchen, because this has been a very viral topic over the course of time, the last time I spotted the World Central Kitchen was 2 days before the attack, they were operating around. A lot of people were benefiting from the worst in their kitchen, but it's the same thing again. It does just, you know, meet the needs of only a tiny part of the population here in Deir Barakura. More than half a million people are taking shelter. If it is about that, the humanitarian aid organizations are operating on the Gaza Strip, why are people ill? Why are the streets filled with injuries if they are literally working? They are being sold in the open markets, the aid they are delivering. So how on earth are people saying that people are getting aid? No, it's in fact a big lie. Whatever they do, I'm sorry, I'm responsible for what I'm saying, because what they do is just for media purposes. They're like, oh, okay, we are doing this kind of stuff because of Gaza. We're just, you know, deriving people's sympathy around the world that we are working inside Gaza. Tell me why I should see my parents every day suffering. And about the medications, I haven't yet got any for myself, for my both parents. Okay, it is the same for my sister who is still praying for God that she won't give birth until this horrific war ends. If this is true also, why poor houses operate daily in the Gaza Strip if the humanitarian aid organizations operate properly in the Gaza Strip, especially in Deir Bala? Are they really operating? They're not, in fact. At all. They're doing just a tiny, you know, process of what they are doing every day. Because a lot of people are depending mainly on poor houses, what we call in Arabic taqiyya. So this is from where they get food. And by the way, these poor houses are run by ordinary people here in the Gaza Strip. They are seeking ajr or reward. So where are the so-called humanitarian aid organization we are talking about? Did not hear it at all. And even when they operate, they're under attack by the Israeli occupation forces, which means that this is a deliberate act of starving the population in the Gaza Strip, and particularly in Deir al-Balah, where more people are still coming to Deir al-Balah and seek refuge, but the living circumstances are truly unbearable.
And when you say, Abu Bakr, that people are still coming into Deir al-Balah, do you know where they're coming from? What
yes,
areas
coming, there has been a big round, a huge number of people coming from the latest Shifa raid. They somehow survived and came to seek refuge here in Deir al-Balah. They don't have anything, so they are completely lost. And at the same time, there are more people are trying to flee from the northern parts of Gaza, like Al-Shuja'iyya, Tufah, and other parts of those areas. But yes, they are not finding places because Deir al-Balah is being too overcrowded, and it is still getting increasingly overcrowded, where no aid, no food, no water is being given very enough for those starving people. And it's just like, you know, that even in people can't find spaces in schools. Even schools are filled or are overcrowded. Even stadiums, football stadiums, all the stadiums in Deir al-Balah and the Gaza Strip that is still sound, Al-Dura Stadium, is now a sanctuary to more than 10,000 people coming from the north of Gaza. Even other clubs like Al-Salah Football Club, which should be a stage for sports and entertainment, is now a sanctuary, is now a refuge for more than 2,000 people. So it's the same story. It's the same tragic story. And even if you talk about it for all eternity, it doesn't make any sense for the people who are behind this genocide.
Abu Bakr, you said that people who have been arriving in central Gaza, where you are, have been coming from neighborhoods around Al-Shifa Hospital, where for two continuous weeks, the Israeli army turned the hospital into a slaughterhouse and as well destroyed the neighborhoods around the medical complex itself. Have you been talking with people who were forced to flee those neighborhoods around Al-Shifa? And yes. If so, what have they been saying about what they endured, what they saw?
Yes, I talked to some of them. One of them told me that when the raid happened, the eyes of the soldiers looked bloodthirsty, that they wanted to kill everybody, that they wanted to strike everyone, everything in the hospital. So that they were not allowed to breathe, so their sounds or their breaths are heard. And then the first thing the Israeli occupation forces told them when they raided the hospital, that they wouldn't harm any civilians. But just then, they killed the 300 of them. At the same time, when they were arrested for investigations, they were handcuffed, they were blindfolded, and they were at the same time, hand and feet bound. When that happened, if somebody, they were arrested for 30 days, that means they were not allowed to do anything all the time across the 2 days. If somebody, that included children, by the way, under the age of 10, when that happened, when a child was asking one of the Israeli occupation forces or soldiers that he wanted to see one of his family, it was shot between his legs. The same if somebody asked for some water. Even the fact that they were fasting did not push the Israeli special forces to deal with them from a religious and Muslim perspective, given the fact that they are fasting and giving them food and water to break their fast or to have support. All of this hasn't been dealt with at all. And it's just that day, he told me, they treated us as human, as animals. That they were shouting at us, that they were not giving us any attention, that they were at the same time dealing with us with disdain. So that they're telling us that you're nothing for us. You are nothing. Even when they were fled, when they were evacuated by them, they had to walk after torture, physically and mentally. They were forced to walk in the same way they were arrested, kilometers, many kilometers, and then after 2 days of arrest, they were obliged to walk from Gaza to Deir el-Balah in the southern area, in the southern territory, just about, you're talking about at least 20 kilometers. That is a lot of suffering. So that's how they treated them.
And Abu Bakr, right now Israel continues to threaten Rafah. You're in Deir el-Balah, you're in the central area, southern central area of Gaza. The next big city to the south is Rafah, which normally, before the genocide, had about 300,000 people, but now it's more than a million and a half people. I've seen some reports who are sheltering there. And Israel continues to threaten that they will attack Rafah. What are people saying about that? Are you seeing people coming from Rafah to Deir el-Balah? Are people trying to now escape from Rafah? What can you tell us about that?
Yes, that's great to bring to the audience, because there is an important point, by the way. Across the last 2 weeks, there have been relentless attacks of the outskirts of Deir el-Balah, of the eastern outskirts of Deir el-Balah. That is the border with the Israeli forces. Now, given this fact, by the way, there was an abrupt invasion about a week ago of Deir el-Balah southern areas in the pre-dawn. So people were traumatized and were terrified that a ground invasion would happen in Deir el-Balah. So people are still fleeing from Rafah to Deir el-Balah, by the way, but at the same time, the speculations that Deir el-Balah is going to be invaded, they are very afraid that Deir el-Balah would be invaded earlier, because we've seen the analyses by military experts saying that Deir el-Balah would be a prior stop to the Israeli military forces to invade, because they want to see if there are they want to operate there. So people are totally bewildered about where they go. It is the same thing for us here in Deir al-Balah, because Rafah is not safe, Deir al-Balah is not safe. At least over the last week, there have been more than 100 killed and hundreds injured in Deir al-Balah and wounded in Deir al-Balah, including the Western kitchen and the four people that were killed. So you think that Deir al-Balah is safe and you think that Rafah is safe. People are coming from Rafah and people are coming from Deir al-Balah. Both areas are literally risky. But both areas, people don't know where to go. Both are unsafe. So it's just a matter of waiting and seeing the news confirmed and waiting for leaflets thrown by the Israeli forces to see which area is going to be invaded. As they did, because a leaflet or leaflets were thrown over there around 2 days ago, and it said, those leaflets said or read that the Israeli occupation forces will go into every meter of the Gaza Strip, will enter every meter of the Gaza Strip. So that's why it has been causing a lot of panic and a lot of terror among people.
Finally, Abu Bakr, we just have a couple minutes left, we also had a story on EI just a few days ago about a man who is building and maintaining a garden in Gaza. And I was speaking to someone the other day who said, you know, it's really important to also remember. Yeah, there's the story. Also remember that Gaza is a beautiful place and still has an immense amount of beauty, even though Israel is trying to destroy it. Can you talk about your Gaza and where you find beauty these days?
Well, this is a great task because it's really important to switch the conversation from. The topic has been quite miserable, to be honest, so we can really smile now. Look, now, the beauty of Gaza is still there all the time. Now, the people, what we are looking for the most, what we are looking at the most, is the little plants growing around. So as I was in the base, I was just like, you know, planting some basil. And by the way, the good news is that I have despite all the circumstances, despite all the miserable and hard circumstances, I have a yellow rose that is now growing very well, by the way. And when the roses are out, I will show them to you, inshallah. So it's going to be great that those roses are going to be growing and that they will be looking very beautiful and will reflect the unprecedented, unmatched beauty of the Gaza Strip. Because that's why even the basil, even the roses, even the plants we are having here, all reflect the inside of our souls. Because our souls are beautiful, because our souls are sincere and at the same time lovely. I believe so. That's why we still have these plants in our area. So Gaza will come back to its beauty one day, it's for sure, and that everyone should feel hope. There's no reason in the world, even the Israeli occupation forces, even amidst the bombing, the destruction and everything, there's no reason that anybody can really upset us. So we are still smiling. Still happy that I'm with you, and it's genocide, and everything. No, I'm so happy. And I, by the way, I'm very happy. I'm delighted to be with you, and that the roses will be out again. I'm very sure. I'm very, very confident, by the way, about that. I'm still watering it every day because this is the beauty of our souls, not the beauty of plants. This is the beauty of causing people, not the destruction. The destruction will not impede us. The destruction will not stop us from seeing beautiful things. That's our soul. That's our essence. And it's something that we want to convey to the world, that we are going to see Gaza beautiful today, tomorrow, and every time. That's what we believe in.
Abu Bakr, you are a beautiful soul. And I personally, and I know many of us will be waiting to see the photos of your yellow roses. Wow. And I know now that the yellow rose for all of us will take on a wonderful symbolic significance. And we're seeing, just so you know, how many messages of love and support there are. People are very moved by what you're saying. And by your continued reporting and writing and continuing to bear witness to what's happening. And we will try to keep doing our part, which is to continue to raise our voices in every way that we can to end this genocide, to stop this massacre. And I'm looking forward to the day when I can visit you in this beautiful Gaza once again.
Thank you so much. Finally, I have a message to all of you, to the viewers and everyone. It's very important to tell you that, believe me, that this time and every time with you, you are the echo of our voices. We are absolutely nothing without you, the echo of our voices. And even when you told me last time that people don't know anything about the Electric Intifada, I told them and they were utterly happy about that. And every comment for the audience who are writing to me at the moment, every comment I write, every literal comment I write, that inspires and empowers me to continue. I'm proud that I write. I'm proud that people listen to us. But what I want to say in the end, that sometimes, as I told you, and I will say it all the time, even under the worst circumstances, when you find your people, you find your healing word. That is literally you. That is literally you. So that's why I'm healing all the time, because of you. You are our healing word here in the Gaza Strip, the echo of our voices. And by the way, you will be the beautiful leaves of the yellow roses that will be coming out soon.
Abu Bakr, we are so grateful and so privileged to know you and to work with you. Thank you so much for spending time with us today. And we'll have you on literally anytime. So please come back soon.
Anytime.
Send us those photos.
Back.
Yeah.
You're very welcome. And I'm telling you all the time, the honor is mine. The happiness is mine. The happiness is our family. But also, it will always be my pleasure. I'm honored and I'm pleased and I'm delighted. So thanks to every one of you. And by the way, if I survive, you probably need to listen from me. A lot of thanks to every one of you. So thank you so much.
Of course. Yes, Abu Bakr Aved.
Thank you.
Our contributor live from the Gaza Strip. Of course, you can go to electronicintifada.net, read his latest story, A Ramadan of Heartbreak. Leave comments on the story because Abu Bakr reads them. And we'll have you back on very soon. Please be safe, of course, as much as possible.
Thank you, Abu Bakr. We'll see you soon.
A Lion of Gaza, indeed. You're watching and listening to the Electronic Intifada live stream. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman with Ali Abu Nima. We're now joined by Dr. Yipeng Gui, a physician based in Ottawa, formerly a resident physician at the University of Ottawa's Faculty of Medicine. In November, Dr. Gui was suspended by the university over social media posts supportive of Palestinian rights. He was reinstated in January, but has not returned. In December, he resigned from the board of the Canadian Medical Association, citing the group's refusal to take a stance in the face of the ongoing Israeli apartheid and genocide. And in February, Dr. Gui spent a week in Gaza's southern city of Rafah. Dr. Yipeng Gui, thank you so much for being with us today on the Electronic Intifada live stream.
Thank you so much for having me.
First off, your thoughts on, what Abu Bakr was talking about in terms of, he's someone with already a chronic illness. He, like so many others, are having to choose between starving or eating, bad quality food. He's talking about hepatitis. He's talking about all the, you know, the effects of not having, you know, of Israel engineering the starvation and forcing people to make these just impossible choices. What are your thoughts on hearing him and knowing what you know about chronic illness and starvation in Gaza?
I mean, it's an honor to first of all be here and to listen to Abu Bakr share his story and also his hope of what gives him hope and I think being in community and being here. So thank you for having me first and foremost, and this is healing for me to be in this space. I think so. I'm a primary care doctor. That's what I have been trained in. I've been trained in emergency rooms across the country in Canada, as well as in under-resourced places like Nunavut in Canada's north. And I thought that was under-resourced until, you know, certainly working in Rafah and bearing witness to what's happening at the European Gaza Hospital in Khan Yunis as well, is a whole different scenario, right? And when I think about chronic disease as a primary care doctor, you know, I'm actually seeing patients this morning and this afternoon after this, is the necessary preconditions to be able to manage a chronic disease is all of the important social determinants of health, of having a roof over your head, having like nutritious food, having clean water, having the ability to have money and education so that you can manage all these other things to have a long, fulfilling, healthy life. And to manage a chronic disease, specifically, you know, certain ones like heart disease or high blood pressure or diabetes or any of the other kinds of chronic diseases that one can encounter, it becomes impossible to manage when you don't have those necessary preconditions for life, for a decent life. Basic human rights, we're talking clean water, we're talking nutritious food, we're talking shelter. And these are things that have been completely systematically withheld or destroyed by Israel in the Gaza Strip. And we know that these things were actually withheld even before October 7th. There's this like Gaza diet that we talk about colloquially, where the number of caloric, the number of calories or the caloric intake of people were calculated so as to not kill people, but to limit and stunt their growth. And I remember meeting children around the clinic that followed me around with their smiles and their greetings. And I thought they were, you know, 4, 5, 6 years old by their height. And I talked to other staff members, people that knew these children at the clinic, and they were like, no, you got it wrong. They're like 10, 11, 12 years old. And so the consequences of this over 17 year blockade on the Gaza Strip, including that of humanitarian aid, is just so severe. And now we're seeing trucks enter at a fraction, a third of what was entering even before, when we knew that those caloric intake was being restricted. And so the ways in which anyone can manage chronic disease is almost impossible. When I think about trying to manage high blood pressure or diabetes, I was really not sure what we were doing in these clinics, because what people needed was food, what people needed was water, and also to manage certain conditions, you do need blood work to kind of ensure that a patient is on a medication safely. There are medications that we actually recommend to not take if you're not feeling well, or if you're having a gastrointestinal infection, a respiratory infection, or if you're not eating and drinking properly. But how can we counsel someone in this situation that maybe don't take your, you know, high blood pressure medications or diabetes medications because you're not eating and drinking? You're not eating and drinking because Israel is withholding these things systematically. And so the medicine that we're trying to do in primary care in Rafah and Khan Yunis is impossible.
And Dr. Guy, thank you again. Thank you so much for joining us. And I mean, and when you talk about chronic illnesses, things that in say, Canada or the United States or in Jordan or in many countries are completely manageable, whether it's high blood pressure or diabetes. You know, these can be very, not to say they're not serious, but they're manageable with diet, with medication. What happens for people when they run out of their diabetes medication or their high blood pressure medication? Or, I mean, we're not talking now about acute illnesses, you know, people, the thousands of people living with cancer in Gaza who are not, who don't have access to care, but we're talking about potentially hundreds of thousands of millions of people who have chronic conditions. And this is not as, you know, we all see on our social media the utter horrors that are happening in Gaza, the shredded bodies, the bombing, the people being rescued from under the rubble. But it's hard to show a picture of what happens to an elderly person who can't control their diabetes or who can't get enough nutrition or can't control their hypertension or whatever it may be. What are we not seeing is what I want to ask you. What did you see that we here are not seeing?
There's so much, right? There's so many stories that are left being untold because I think there's a degree of desperation to humanize Palestinians and what they're going through. And I think a lot of the attention is being paid to women and children, for example, when we know that Palestinian men are being slaughtered in Al-Shifa Hospital, for example, like all of them. And doctors are being slaughtered. And I think the ways in which I think about the healthcare impacts of what we saw, not only is it the overlapping crises of food, water, and shelter insecurity that has completely decimated everyone, has affected everyone, but when we think about who is most vulnerable, we do think about children, we think about infants, but there's also older adults, people with chronic diseases, people with disabilities, visible disabilities, also more hidden disabilities. I spoke to a psychiatrist and a pharmacist at one of the primary care clinics where mental health medications, like antipsychotic medications for people with schizophrenia, has just been completely forgotten about. And so there are people that I don't even know where they are because as a doctor, when you're there as a foreign doctor, you're not allowed to leave the medical compound. There's this thing called deconfliction where if you're in a deconflicted zone, then you're not supposed to leave unless if you, you know, tell the UN and whatever. And so there are patients in like active psychosis that haven't received their antipsychotic medications for months, probably 6 months now, that are just suffering, and their family members, I'm sure, are trying to manage and cope. And so there, when we think about who is most vulnerable in society, a lot of these humans, right, like adults with chronic diseases, like cancer, like all these other chronic diseases that we've already mentioned, are being completely forgotten. There's a challenge, and I remember Dr. Ben Thompson's interview with both of you here, you know, the challenge of diagnosing cancer now with, there's no CT scanners, really, and there's no imaging capability, really limited blood work capability. The main, you know, laboratory was in Al-Shifa Hospital, which is completely destroyed now. Everything has been destroyed at Al-Shifa Hospital to the point where there's no pathologists to make a tissue diagnosis for cancer. So you can't diagnose cancer now in any kind of like sort of the word in a way that is standard care, you know, quality standard care. And there's also no way to treat cancer. And so all of these chronic diseases are really much, very much in the shadows with respect to what's happening. And when we talk about the number of deaths, it's such a gross underestimate. The numbers I think about of the children dying of starvation, for example, those numbers came from the north, and they came when I left Rafah. And I treated patients that had such severe malnutrition that I was worried that they were going to die the next day, if not the next week. And, you know, the patients that started to be counted in the north, they had the privilege of dying in front of a nurse or a doctor to be counted. And so I think about all of those untold stories of the children, older adults, you know, people with chronic diseases, people with disabilities that are dying of starvation or dehydration or any other chronic disease and are not being counted because they can't get to a clinic or a hospital because healthcare has been systematically attacked and destroyed in the entire Gaza Strip.
Yeah.
So there's just so many stories left untold. When there is a ceasefire, and I know there will be one, and when humanitarian aid can enter unrestricted, that is when the horrors actually come. You know, I think about how when I was there in Rafah, I was speaking to the colleagues that I went with and the other doctors, you know, I could not comprehend the suffering that was happening. It was incomprehensible. And to know that it's actually getting worse each day, each passing week, is still unimaginable, because I think so many of us still hold on to our humanity. We still recognize and see the humanity in others.
Dr. Key, during this latest siege of Al-Shifa and the horrors that were revealed in the last few days after the Israeli forces withdrew, one of the facts that came out is that the Israeli forces essentially executed Dr. Ahmed Maqadma. Tamara, I don't know if you can see in the chat, I dropped a tweet from Dr. Hassan Abu Sitta, the British Palestinian surgeon who was in Gaza for so long at the beginning of this genocide, and he paid tribute to Dr. Ahmed Maqadma, who was executed, according to the reports that came out, along with his mother at Al-Shifa Hospital, and many tributes to him, paying tribute to the fact that he never left the side of his patients, that he continued to try to care for them until his last moment. And I'd just like to ask you, Dr. Guy, just tell us about some of, and of course, Dr. Ahmed is among so many medical workers and doctors who have been targeted and murdered, first responders, rescue workers who have been targeted and murdered by Israel. But I just want to ask you to talk about some of your colleagues in Gaza who you met and what you can tell us about them.
You know, the doctors and the nurses, the medical volunteers that I met while in Gaza, I think uphold the highest levels of medical professionalism and ethics and morals that we enter this profession with, to help our patients and communities, no matter who they are, and also this deep commitment and moral clarity as to, in the face of bombs dropping around you, you don't abandon your patients. You look after your patients and you care for them because you have the skills and expertise to help, and you do what you can, unfortunately, to the last moment for some of these patients, for some of these doctors. I have the deepest respect for these doctors. Like, they, and I only wish I knew them for longer, or some of them I wish I got the chance to meet them. I think about my colleagues in Canada, like Dr. Tarek Lubani or Dr. Ben Thompson, who have not only been bearing witness to what's happening, and Ben Thompson coming back from Gaza recently as well himself, mm-hmm. but to have lost close friends, mm-hmm. to have lost doctors that they've trained with and trained themselves, because they knew about the importance of building capacity in Gaza, giving people who are Palestinian in Gaza the tools and the skills and expertise to look after their own community and their own peoples. And what we're seeing right now is a systematic destruction of that, to destroy the hospitals, to destroy like the people that are in these hospitals trying to care for their community and population, to the point of not only making the situation and the make life unlivable, but to make it impossible to receive medical care at this point. As I watched the 8 or so minute press conference by the head doctor, surgeon at the Al-Shifa hospital last night, and it's just been completely decimated. And yet they continue to try to care for their patients. Like one of the doctors that I met at the primary care clinic, they themselves are from the north, from Al-Shifa area, and have been displaced 4 or 5 times, lost family members, lost their home, and they're living in a tent outside of this primary care clinic and doing the unimaginable work of trying to do what they can in treating, you know, bacterial pneumonias, bacterial gastroenteritis, so much hepatitis A, wound infections. But when patients need food and water, and there is none, and to see dehydrated children and malnourished children, and to only give them IV fluid, which introduces another source of possible infection, introduces, makes the child like cry, and it's irritating, and it causes trauma, and the parent or the guardian or the adult, or sometimes it's just like another sibling that's with them because they've lost so many family members. It's distressing for them as well. And yet, despite all this, they continue and persist and find ways to care for their patients. If anything, it's to see and to hear someone deeply. And that is a lot of what I do in primary care here in Canada, is to recognize someone suffering. And sometimes you don't have the material conditions in which someone needs to heal, but at least you get this opportunity to like spend time with them and see them as a full complex human, and to share that human experience with someone. But I think even that is being destroyed impossible to do in Gaza right now because of how many patients there are and how stretched the resources are, to the point where in the primary care clinic, I was seeing patients so quickly that it was like 60 to 70 patients in a matter of a half day, so in the matter of a morning. And there's no real way to actually have a meaningful conversation other than just screening for a couple of symptoms and just, you know, getting them some medication that they might need. You know, the clinics that we went to didn't have antibiotics when we arrived. We brought a supply of antibiotics and started prescribing those, but this is not a solution. There's no humanitarian solution to what's happening. We're seeing systematic attacks on healthcare, on people who heal, as Dr. Tanya Hassan has already put it so clearly, that healthcare workers have a direct target on their back, to the point where they're changing out of their scrubs into civilian clothes because they know that they're going to, because civilians know too, that they're going to be taken by the Israeli forces, detained, tortured, and executed. And it's despite all this, they persist. And I'm so honored to call them my colleagues.
Yeah. We only have a few minutes left, Dr. Ghee, but I wanted to ask about the response we've seen like the complete failure of the American Medical Association, for example, here in the States, to express any sort of even just mild condemnation of Israel's decimation of Gaza's healthcare system. And we've seen pretty much the same in Canada, where you work and live. There seems to be absolutely no solidarity at all within the Canadian medical establishment for their colleagues risking their lives to treat patients in Gaza. Can you talk a little bit about that and what, you know, as you returned from Gaza back to Canada, what the response has been from your colleagues in Ottawa?
You know, the clinics that I work at in Ottawa and in the greater Ottawa region have actually been really supportive. Like, people have reached out to me to say, like, thank you for what you're doing. And but I think there's still this blanket atmosphere of silencing, of anti-Palestinian racism, of people with their own internalized anti-Semitism, afraid of being called out as anti-Semitic for any speech related to Palestine. And, you know, I think the medical establishment in Canada as a whole, as institutions, continue to be extremely silent. If anything, they're perpetuating anti-Palestinian racism by creating the conditions in which people are afraid to speak up because they are disciplining doctors, medical students, residents. But I will say, I think the tide is very much turning, where we have coalitions of doctors and other health professionals creating communities of care, of support. I think about Health Workers Alliance for Palestine, based in Canada. We have members across Canada now from many different backgrounds in healthcare, including doctors, nurses, social workers, naturopaths, occupational therapists, dietitians, dentists even. And so there is, the tide is turning in terms of how do we co-create the like coalitions that we want to see through the same values and principles that we share. And how do we do this work in healthcare to help liberate Palestine as in the way that Palestine and Gaza are liberating us from the very clear, blatant abuses of institutional power rooted in anti-Palestinian racism. And we're seeing doctors, I think, over time now, unfortunately, it's taken 6 months, growing a backbone to speak up. We see a group of doctors in Quebec that have written an open letter to their college to demand a statement, and their college responded with said statement. We have over 1,000 doctors doing the same for the Canadian Medical Association, but they continue to take the stance of being neutral in the face of structural oppression and ongoing genocide. When, you know, this is an organization that I was on the board of just last year, and knowing what they did for Ukraine, actually, I don't know if everyone is aware of what the Canadian Medical Association did for Ukraine when the Russian Federation escalated and invaded Ukraine, was that they put out multiple statements in support of Ukraine related to healthcare as well. And then they went so far as to divest from the Russian Federation and made a separate post about that, separate statement. And then they worked with other healthcare institutions in Canada, including pediatric healthcare institutions, to fundraise for humanitarian aid. And they put out of pocket for themselves $250,000 for humanitarian aid for Ukraine. And it's been complete radio silence for Palestine and for Gaza. And so the racist double standards could not be any more clear.
And you actually resigned from the Canadian Medical Association board over that, and you wrote a very eloquent and powerful letter that you actually published. A couple of things. I know that we only have a minute or so, but I just wanted to comment on a couple of things you said. It strikes me, as Nora said in the introduction, that you were suspended in November for things that you said related to Gaza. Dr. Ben Thompson, your colleague who we had on, he was suspended for things he said. You don't need to go into the details of that. But the point is that here are doctors actually being punished for doing the very thing that we're all taught doctors are supposed to do, which is to care first and foremost for human life, to have compassion, the Hippocratic Oath, first do no harm, you know, to heal people. And so it just strikes me that these institutions are actually punishing you for standing by the most marginalized people. So it's very heartening to see, you know, to hear from you about how doctors are now organizing, not just doctors, but people in the medical profession, organizing to push back and to speak out. And the other thing I want to say is the importance of the voice of medical workers, because remember this, that Israel deliberately, as a propaganda strategy, pushed so-called first responders. In many cases, they weren't actually first responders. They were Israeli military personnel, or they came from that Jewish extremist group, Zaka. But they pushed them into the media, to tell atrocity stories, things that turned out to be complete lies, because they made a calculation, and they said it, that, oh, people trust first responders. They trust people who are rescuers or who are in the medical profession. So let's push them out to tell their lies. So Israel actually tried to weaponize the trust and respect that people have for first responders and medical workers in the service of genocide, in the service of propaganda. There were even 100 Israeli doctors who notoriously signed a letter supporting the war and the genocide. So I just wanted to commend you, and on behalf of many of our viewers who are reflecting that, for speaking out, for your insistence on doing so, and to give every encouragement to the medical workers in Canada who are now organizing to do that collectively. It's so vital.
Well, thank you so much for your kind words. I mean, I think about what I signed up for in medicine, but also the framing in which I entered medicine is through the framing of wanting to work on structural oppression and racism and colonialism from a healthcare lens. That's always been my work. My work has been in indigenous health and anti-racism and decolonizing health and healthcare, including public health, for over 10 years now. And that is the context in which I entered and learned about the issue of Palestine, from the framing of settler colonialism as a structural determinant of health. And so what we've also seen through these attacks and reprisals is that they do not stand the test of time. Like the University of Ottawa completely walked back their indefinite suspension on me without any disciplinary action, but did not so much, you know, offer apology or remorse or any reassurance that this wouldn't happen to me or anyone else in the future. And it's just so ironic that they, you know, continue to have their articles about me and my work for patients and community, because that's what it's always about, instead of upholding these institutions that continue to abuse their institutional power rooted in anti-Palestinian racism. But, you know, I think we have to continue to center the Palestinians in Gaza that are experiencing an ongoing genocide. These front lines that are happening in Canada and the United States on university campuses, at medical schools, this anti-Palestinian racism, it is so important to tackle as well, but it is very much a distraction, and a distraction from the atrocities of what's happening in Gaza, right? Where people want to center what's happening in Gaza, calling attention to it, you know, wanting, you know, universities, medical schools to take part in BDS campaigns, and then people are getting this anti-Palestinian racism backlash that is completely racist and discriminatory in of itself. So I do see the tides turning, and very much like what I'm doing is just what feels right as the next step. Like I want to tell myself in the, you know, months and years to come and the decades to come, if I live that long, that I did everything that I could in this moment, everything within my power, to put an end to this ongoing genocide. And I think more and more doctors in Canada and other healthcare professionals are certainly getting more comfortable because there's power in numbers and we protect each other. Like in the way that Dr. Ben Thompson reached out to me and protected me in many, many ways. You know, I got suspended at 8 o'clock in the morning on a Sunday from a phone call by someone who didn't even make the decision. So they were just a messenger. And before noon, I had already had a 1 hour conversation with Ben Thompson, who I didn't know at that point, about strategy and next steps and getting in touch with his legal team, mm-hmm. who became my legal team as well. So there are certainly ways to push beyond anti-Palestinian racism and also see it as an opportunity that we will not go down without a fight. If anything, we're going to take retaliatory actions, like Dr. Penn Thompson is suing the hospital now that suspended him out of racism.
Yeah. Thank you so much for all of your work and for being, you know, really an instructive mentor to other, you know, young physicians who are watching what's happening and watching how people are using their consciousness and their morals and ethics, you know, really living up to the oath that physicians take to help people. And so your work is extraordinary. Thank you so much for being with us. We hope that you can come back on at some point soon. There's so much to talk about in terms of health care and the crushing of the health system in Gaza. So we'd love to have you back on.
For sure. Thank you so much for the conversation.
Thank you so much. Dr. Yiping Gui, a physician based in Ottawa. How can people read your posts and follow you on Twitter? What's your handle?
I'm on Twitter and Instagram. And my Instagram handle is my first name, Yiping, period, G-E. And my Twitter account is also just my name.
Excellent. And your website we have down there on the bottom at the scroll, yiping.ca. Thank you so much, Dr. Gui.
Thank you.
Thank you. And you are watching and listening to the Electronic Intifada live stream. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman with Ali Abu Nima, and we wanted to bring on our colleague, David Cronin, who wrote, hi, Dave.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Good to see you.
Nice to see you back, David.
Tell us about what happened. You were censored by a Dutch university. Tell us about why and what's happened since.
Yeah. Well, as I'm sure you're aware, Nora, for a number of years now, there's been an annual event called Israel Apartheid Week. Israel Apartheid Week is marked in universities across the world. It focuses on Israel's crimes against the Palestinian people. It has been held for a number of years in the University of Groningen in the...
Welcome back, and that was Electronic Intifada, day 180, and that program covered a number of issues, principally the healthcare crisis inside of Gaza, which has been systematically targeted and destroyed by the Israeli Defense Forces, funded and armed by the United States. And that's going to conclude our program for today. You've been listening to the Pan-African Journal worldwide radio broadcast, and this has been aired on Saturday, April the 6th, 2024. We've been broadcasting from our studios in downtown Detroit. If you'd like to have access to this program, just go to our website, and that is at Pan-African Radio Network. The Pan-African Radio Network can be reached at blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. That's blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. If you'd like to read the Pan-African Newswire, you can log on at panafricannews.blogspot.com. That's panafricannews.blogspot.com. And the Pan-African Journal, a worldwide radio broadcast, is available by merely logging on to the Pan-African Newswire or the Pan-African Journal at blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. We'll close out with the music of John Coltrane, Afro Blue, a live performance in Japan. This is Abayomi Azikiwe signing off, and have a beautiful week.
We'll be right back.